So I'm curious. I'm going to ask Steve. Could you talk about growing up, family, church? How did you become who you are?
That's a good question. Well, I want to start again. Just thank you all for the welcome. And somebody said that Oklahoma is the largest county in Texas. And having discovered that, and then having eaten some more of this food, I'm thinking I don't even have to leave Texas to come here. This is awesome. So yeah, I probably should sketch a bit more background than that. So I was born in Holtwhistle, which is a tiny little town right up in the northeast of England. My mum and dad were both school teachers, and they moved from there, where there really wasn't work, down to the Midlands, a place called Coventry. They weren't Christians when I was born. I wasn't baptized as a kid, or not as a baby. My father died when I was four. My mum was looked after by some Christians who took her to a church where my brother and I, who's a couple of years younger, we kind of grew up in that church, St. James's in Tile Hill in Coventry. And it was a sort of large-ish, soft, charismatic, Anglican-ish church, basically. If that sounds like a confused muddle, then that's because it's an Anglican church. The Church of England is very varied, and those aspects of it which are perhaps most prominent in your impressions of the Anglican Church from this side of the pond, I don't know what they would be, but you may be you may think of the history and the beauty of the buildings and the liturgy, and it's you know, great moments in the past in its theological stand, and there have been those, and there still are some, but it's also a very broad church in all sorts of not so helpful ways. But anyway, I was raised in that church. My mum remarried when I was eight, a Christian man. We moved south to just west of Oxford, and that's really where I was raised, I guess, in a little town called Whitney. I was in the choir in an Anglican church, middle of the road Anglican church, with a slightly more modern liturgy, robed choir. So a lot of the beauty, not quite the beauty of the singing and the worship here, but a lot of those accoutrements, but not much in the way of gospel preaching. In fact, not much at all in the way of anything preaching-wise. And I have to say, in fairness, if the gospel had been preached, I probably wouldn't have been that interested. Although you never know, do you? I noticed a distinct difference in what I was hearing when I moved to university. My wife and I met in Oxford, and there are a couple of churches there which they're different from each other, both Anglican churches, and both had a significant influence on both of us. And I guess I grew in my faith. It wasn't a kind of, I was a religious person, then I went to college and discovered Jesus. It wasn't like that. But it was, I thought really quite highly of myself as a religious Anglican, and then discovered to my amazement that there were people who actually read the Bible and knew what it said about things. And I did the stupidest thing. I remember sitting in a Christian Union meeting at college in my first year and thinking, I literally don't understand the words these people are saying. What do they mean, the gospel? What are they talking about? You know, it was that kind of level of cluelessness that I had. And so I did the stupidest thing you could possibly have imagine at that point. I just kept my mouth shut and played along like I knew what everybody was talking about, rather than having the courage and the humility to fess up and say, well, please, will somebody explain what it is that you all believe? So it took me about a year rather than about 3 weeks to figure out sort of some of the contours of what it was that my friends at college were believed and why they were living the way they did. And so I guess I became a Christian at some point between the age of, I don't know, 4 and 18. Does that answer the question? I can't remember what the question was. There was a couple of other moments. So Nicole arrived at college a year after me. We were actually about the same age, but Nicole had spent a year doing something. We've been working as an engineer. Nicole's an engineer and worked for ICI, which is an old chemical company in England. And we met, and Nicole is one of the people. I'll tell you a bit about Nicole, actually, because Nicole was raised as a Catholic by loving parents. Her mum is an Austrian Catholic, moved to England. Her father is agnostic, about the most thoughtful person you could hope to meet who's not a believer, a delightful, lovely man. You might pray for him. His name's Richard. Ava is a Catholic, and they've both become more thoughtful, I think, in their older age. And Nicole did the thing you're not supposed to do if you're a Catholic. When you're given that Gideon's Bible at school, she took it home and read it. And I guess, would this be overstating it? You came to Oxford, you found evangelical preaching, and it was like, this is what I've been hoping for. You know that. So I guess Nicole's kindled faith predated mine in her teenage years. You know, she's reading the Bible in a way that I certainly wasn't. I didn't know they had two testaments. You know. So anyway, and we sort of bumbled through college together and getting to know each other better, and we married in 1999. We have three kids. The youngest is over there. We have two older, 20 and 18, Ben and Becky, who are away at college in Dallas now. They're all believers. They love the Lord, and they've been a huge blessing to us. So that's kind of my... I didn't talk about... I should probably talk about how I ended up being a minister, shouldn't I? So, again, this was... I'll only tell you this if you promise never to let your children do it, because it's really, really stupid. I did an undergrad degree, 4 years, then I did a graduate study, I did a PhD, and quite soon after that started, I decided I didn't want, after all, to be an academic and a scientist, and there were various reasons for that, but I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I thought I'll carry on doing the PhD, because it doesn't look great on your resume to start a PhD and then quit, and it was funded anyway. I didn't know what else I wanted to do. I thought I'll finish this. I assumed that I would go into industry somewhere or something like that, and during that time, that was a time of very significant Christian growth for me. We got married in near the beginning, well, kind of halfway through my PhD, didn't we? And I was traveling back and forth between Oxford and a little town on the west side of London every day. So I had 2 hours on the train, and I just basically read theology the whole time. So my faith was growing wonderfully. I was discovering more about the Lord. And I think in a very, very immature way, I thought I wanted to be like the people who I was feeling so blessed by, the preachers I was listening to, the pastors and theologians whose books I was reading. And so I thought, I know, maybe I'll come and become a pastor. That's ridiculous. What was I doing? And it was at a time in Britain where this was late 90s, early 2000, there was quite a lot of money sloshing around. Churches were growing quite rapidly, evangelical churches at least were growing. There was a strong emphasis on church planting and on the training of men for ministry in evangelical contexts. And churches were starting to put on these apprenticeship training schemes, like a kind of pastoral internship. And mercifully, I ended up doing one of those rather than just applying for a job as an assistant pastor or something, because the very grave danger if I'd applied for a job, I might have got one because they were so desperate. They might have actually... And that would have been an unmitigated catastrophe, because I would have had no clue about what I was doing. Instead, I had 3 years of internship under, alongside a bunch of other guys my own sort of age, learning the ropes, again, growing spiritually, wrestling with some questions I hadn't had to wrestle with before, personal questions, and learning some of the skills of day-to-day ministerial life, and a little bit about preaching, a little bit about leading people in studying scripture, and some of the convictions about what Christian ministry ought to entail, and the centrality of the word and prayer and worship, that have informed my pastoral ministry ever since, and I'm very grateful. So that was, the senior pastor was Richard Kokin. Again, he would probably feel slightly uncomfortable here. He's more kind of low church evangelical, but a very, very fine preacher, very, very fine preacher, and I'm grateful to God for him. And I wanted to give up many times in the first 18 months of that time especially. And there was one moment, about 18 months in, we had this interview. There were six interns, and we with our wives were interviewed one at a time by the elders of the church. And I thought, this is the moment where I get rumbled and they discover what a fraud I am. And they'll be, you know, well done, Steve, you've had a crack at it, but we think, you know, you're better off going to be a physicist or something where you know what you're talking about, because you clearly don't know what you're doing here. And to my astonishment, they said, yeah, no, we want to recommend that you train as a pastor. But one of them said at one point, he said, Steve, we can tell you're not the finished article. Really? You amazed me. They wanted me to go to seminary immediately after 2 years. I asked if we could stay for another year because I just felt like I wasn't ready for that. I was still learning too much. And I was very glad I did that. And Nicole is so competent as an engineer. She was earning easily enough money to pay for us. So she was just working away. We didn't have any kids at that time. And so I could... I stayed for a third year as an intern and then went to seminary in 2003. And that was hugely... beneficial. I was 25, 26 years old, but I was still too young to be even embarking on theological training seriously. So then I went to Oak Hill in North London, which was at the time an outstanding place, and actually had a tough time for the last 10 years or so, but more recently has got back as its principal one of my Old Testament professors from when I was there, James Robson. If you ever get a chance, to do a Hebrew class with James Robson, right, you have to take it, or Old Testament, or anything. Like, I've got to tell you this story. After at Oak Hill, he left Oak Hill in about 2010, I guess, 2009. Yeah, 2009. He went to Oxford University, to Wycliffe Hall Theological Training Institute there. He won the university prize, not the theology faculty prize, the university prize for the best use of IT in teaching. Anybody in the university. He's just a brilliant, brilliant teacher. I regret that he's probably going to be too busy for us to snag him for the Reformed Evangelical Seminary, but I'm going to try, believe me. But anyway, so James Robson, I had a bunch of other professors who had a huge influence on me. David Field, who I mentioned today, the guy who coined the term post-mill spirituality. He taught me ethics and theology. Mike Ovey, who died, was a good guy. A couple of quirks, but good, great theologian. Gary Williams, Matthew Sleeman, who taught New Testament, who's her godfather, a couple of other great people, and that was just a huge time of growing for me. I went into seminary with a bunch of friends, and we'd all got some kind of pastoral experience as interns or whatever, and I think, again, we idiotically thought we'd basically got this sort of theology thing nailed, we just needed to learn a bit of Greek, and they just blew our hair out, you know, when the faculty was so good. I remember sitting in one lecture on the book of Judges. This was James Robson teaching. And I went into him afterwards and I said, James, you have completely transformed the way I think about the whole Bible. And you've certainly transformed the way I would ever try and teach the book of Judges. And he said, oh, so what would you have done? I said, well, probably in the past I would have gone, you know, a little bit in Judges 1 and 2, and then maybe a couple of sermons from the middle, you know, Othniel, Gideon, probably the one on Samson, because everybody's heard of him, and then maybe one on the mess at the end, and then we're done, you know, 5 or 6 sermons. And the look of pain on his face. It's like going through Romans in 5 minutes for him. And he said, so what would you do now? And I said, I think I'll probably take about 6 months to get through chapter 1, because you've shown me how much richness and depth there is in the scriptures. And he was like, phew. if I look back, I made more or less every mistake you could make that's not totally disqualifying from the ministry. And I'm, you know, God has been very kind in putting some great people that I've learned a huge amount from, and, you know, clinging to their coattails and trying not to break anything now. And then I come to America and meet this guy. It's like, this can get better, and apparently it can. So that's been a blast.
That's flattery. We've had this.
No, it's Mark. I got to tell you, while I've got the now you can't stop me now. You see, Mark has been a tremendous blessing to our presbytery. I mentioned to a number of you on Friday that my reaction to hearing just his devotion at the start of our most recent presbytery meeting was a good job. I didn't hear that 25 years ago. I really would have tossed in any thought of becoming a pastor and just come and sat under Mark's ministry. But he's the grown-up in every room. Hear me out. He's the grown-up in every room when he's trying to be. And seriously, he's the guy, you know, if Pastor Randy Booth wants to turn to somebody to chair the meeting when something difficult comes up, he turns to this man. And so thank you for letting us have him, and for supporting him as you guys do. And I know you're blessed by his ministry. We're blessed by you through him. So thank you.
Thank you.
I am actually now done with that. So next question.
All right. So talk about you had some support at Emmanuel for a long time before you came to the US.
Yeah, so the first church, okay, after seminary 2007 came out, I was an assistant pastor for 2 years before the opportunity arose to lead a church plant in London called Emmanuel, which was as close to the CREC as it's possible to be without actually being in the CREC. The reason we weren't in the CREC was partly because of some local politics and partly because our next nearest presbytery member was in Krakow, which is in Poland. And I know for you guys that's not very far away from England, but for us it's like three countries away. And so it didn't, I think it probably, if I look back, I might have made this decision differently, but at the time we decided it wouldn't work so well for us to be formally members of the CREC. But I was invited over in 2008 by Pastor Douglas Wilson to raise funds for this proposed church plant in London. He said, you've got 5 minutes, full disclosure, no arm twisting. So I said, okay, well, that's fair. So I just explained what we were trying to do. And a number of churches, Christ Church in Moscow, Trinity Reformed Church in Moscow, Church of the Redeemer in, well, what became Church of the Redeemer in West Monroe, All Saints Presbyterian Church, and a number of others over the years, heard about what we were seeking to do there and had supported the ministry in London for well over a decade, so that my children have never gone without shoes. That was a little joke that David Field used to have. David Field, who's at Oak Hill, became one of the elders in that church. Again, another huge blessing. And yeah, so we were helped along in those early years and still now by giving from CREC churches, and the church is still going. It's now pastored by one of the founding elders, Steve Hayhout, very fine preacher and pastor and leader. And yeah, so we've had those kind of CREC connections since 2009. In 2018, I was invited to consider a pastoral call over here, and so yeah, that became a bit of a long story because we decided to do it the legal way. Took COVID and United States citizenship and immigration, and it took quite a long time, but anyway, here we are. So, yeah. I feel like I've been in the CREC for about 15 years, although technically I've only been in it for three. So, it's been a blast so far.
I knew Pastor Neil for 10 years. 10 years ago, I think 2013 was when I first met him. And I visited All Saints then. You've had a lot of growth at the church, and I think Pastor Neil is planting in another part. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so All Saints began with somewhere around 50 or 60, I forget the exact number, maybe it was a little bit more than that, back in 2009 or 2010, that kind of time. Basically grew by about 10% a year for 10 years. And from 2020, the growth rate increased. And we thought initially this is just a kind of post-COVID bump. But it carried on. And it became evident that it wasn't just people coming to us because their churches still hadn't opened again. It was, there are other sociological and maybe theological and eschatological forces at work. And God has been very kind. So we grew through to about 2022. The growth rate increased about 20-something percent. Then in the last year, by God's grace, we've added about 100 people. So we're now at 370. And Pastor Neil, who's the first pastor, it wasn't the founding pastor, the church was founded a little before he came, but the first pastor had been there for well over a decade, is now leading a church plant. It's actually not in the Metroplex. It's in Granbury, about 45 minutes southwest of Fort Worth. So we've got about 80 people or 70 people who live in Granbury and another 30 or so who live near-ish, so that they're going to go and join this new church plant. They'll start with about 100 people on, Lord willing, 14th of January. Pastor Neil will be their founding pastor, and that will leave myself and Pastor Jeff Shaw. We accumulate pastors called Jeff or Jeffrey. So Jeff Shaw will be with me at All Saints. So if you know any other pastors called Jeff, we're going to need some more. Because we'll probably get it, yeah. If we've run out of space in our building, it's slightly frustrating. So we've we're going to get a year's grace probably at present growth rates. I mean, you never know what the future holds, but our building will just about squeeze us all in at least on the 14th of January until more people start coming if they do.
So they started sharing with the Disciples of Christ Church that had gotten very small, and they shared that building with them the way we have done. And then the church gave them, I don't know all the details, but gave them the building. And so then they had their building, but now they have much, much, much outgrown that building. Yep. And so they're back in the, with an eye to a building. So it's a, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
All right, questions. Okay, right here. Let's go with the young question.
Why is it that you came to America?
It was the food. No, I'm joking. honestly, I'd never wanted to leave London. I'd thought I would pastor at Emmanuel for my whole life. My children had never known anything apart from London. They were all born there. It was the one place I didn't want to live when I was a kid, but I grew to like it. But anyway, I had no thought of leaving. I came over in 2018 on sabbatical and spent a couple of weeks at All Saints in Fort Worth. And during that time, the elders asked if I would consider a pastoral call out here to serve alongside Pastor Neil. And, okay, so a few years previously, I'd had a similar invitation to go to a church in a very, very beautiful part of the US that was twice the size of Emmanuel at the time and was growing, and they wanted a pastor. And a gentleman got in touch, CREC Church, got in touch with me and said, would I be interested? And I just said no immediately and gave him about three reasons why. And then I told Nicole about it. And the reason was because Emmanuel was at that time going through a very, very difficult period. And I just thought I couldn't be sure of my motives for leaving. It's not that it wasn't an appealing prospect or that I didn't think maybe I might be able to offer something. But 3 years before that, 2015 or 2016, I thought I can't leave Emmanuel now, because if somebody offers you a post as a pastor, it's not like if you're an engineer and somebody offers you a post in a nicer part of the country with more money and you can just go, that's fine. You serve your notice period out. And if, as a pastor, you have a kind of obligation to the people that you're with, and you have to make sure if you're going to leave, you're going to leave for the right reason. But in 2018, Emmanuel had never been in better spirits. It was thriving, it was larger than it had ever been, everything was going really well. And then the elders at All Saints said, would you be interested? And I thought, I really don't want to leave. But when they described what they wanted another pastor to do and to focus on, it just looked like a much closer match to my gifts than what I was actually spending quite a lot of time doing in London. And what I was doing in London reflected the fact that my weaknesses include no managerial experience, no corporate experience, no delegation experience, no, I'm not interested in building structures. And so after 10 years, we'd still not got a formal constitution. But I preached and taught the word and did one-to-one Bible studies and did evangelism and did pastoral stuff. And that's what they wanted somebody to focus on. So I thought, honestly, this does look like a better match. If we could find somebody to fill the gap in London, then it wouldn't seem to be wrong to contemplate this. So that's, and of course, it then means that my kids have got to move 5,000 miles, which, bit of a, you know, they all got their future planned out, and then comes dad and drops a rock on them. So they've been, it's tough, you know. But I did point out, you know, it's Fort Worth, it's not Mogadishu. And that's actually worth, yeah, I know, they do speak a form of English down there. Y'all. I'm very, very proud of my children for having handled the disruption so with such maturity, and for my wife as well, who just kind of, she's like the, You know, this illustration could be taken the wrong way, but she's like the ballast in the boat. Now, you know how you can take it the wrong way. It's not what I mean. She's more like the boat, actually. And there's me trying to steer it. But she kind of holds the family together wonderfully. So that's the medium length version of the story. Yeah. And the lesson, just on reflection, I think, it's not that the lesson that I draw as I look back, it's not that you just trust the Lord and don't think about it. But if you're doing what you think is the right thing for the right reasons, and then you look how the Lord uses that providentially. Pastor Neil had a stroke 3 weeks before we arrived. He's a very, very conscientious, thoughtful, a theologically very astute pastor. But that it became very evident in one sense that we arrived at just the right moment. And I'd never would have known that in 2018. We arrived in 2020. You know, so the Lord, I think, used this process, and we're very grateful. So you just think of yourself as you're a jar in the hand of the potter, and make sure you don't do anything stupid, and just trust the Lord.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Jerry, he has my question. Okay. All right, another question. It doesn't have to be biographical. It could be... biblical or whatever.
I arrived late, so I probably maybe missed something relevant, but I guess I'll throw it out. So what are your thoughts on the overall, speaking, you know, for example, we're talking about eschatology this morning and whatnot. What are your thoughts on the overall health of the Christian church, specifically in Europe and England?
The spiritual health of the church in Europe and England. So Europe is, you know this, I know. Europe is not a country, it's quite a lot of different countries. Yeah, I know you know that, I know. But the underlying point is an important one. It's very varied. And each country and each part of every country tells its own story. But it suffice it to say that it, whether it's... street level nominal Roman Catholicism, which borders on kind of superstition in France and Italy and parts of Spain, or whether it's just secularism or growth of Islam or other forms of very superficial Christian commitment. Depending where you are, you see various shades of that. You don't see many thriving, self-consciously Protestant, Reformed, joyfully evangelical congregations. It's not to say there aren't any, but they don't have the place on the landscape, even that they do here, and recognizing, of course, that it's not like Oklahoma is Reformed, is it? So it's not great. There is still much land to be taken. That said, even in England, I can talk about England with a bit more detail, broadly evangelical and reformed churches are the only ones that are growing. They're growing at a rate of about 1% or 2% a year, which is very slow. But at the same time, if you just roll that forward 1,000 generations, it's not too slow. I'm very, very hopeful that the next 10 or 20 years in England may see more of what started in about 2000 and then was abruptly stopped in about 2010, a growth in self-consciously historic reformed, biblically saturated, theologically nuanced churches that maybe even embrace some of the distinctives that have been lost since our Puritan forefathers, like a kind of a post-mill eschatology, like a high regard for the sacraments, but that isn't a Roman Catholic regard for the sacraments. And a lot of that has to do with my hopes for Oak Hill, the college I trained at. It was going great, and then some bad things happened about 2008, 2009, and derailed it for a decade or more. And James Robson is nothing but good news by grace of God to that institution and perhaps for the church more broadly. So yeah, it's ups and downs. And I've got lots of friends in the Church of England who are in the process of leaving the Church of England because of its, you know, they just reached the end of the road with its doctrinal compromise. But yeah, it's patchy with glimmers of light here and there.
How about just a follow-up then? Yeah. How about the rest of it, like Scotland?
Yeah, I don't. I know so little about Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland and the Republic. I don't. Really, you'd learn more reliably from Wikipedia than me. This is really saying something.
Brian?
Yeah.
This is not really a question. It's more of a comment on your sermon. It was a humbling point that I think that was made for me personally. Growing up in the sort of standard evangelical culture in the United States, that the patience of God is for those who are lost. He's not willing that any should perish, but also come to repentance. But something that really struck me during the sermon is that the kingdom of God is supposed to not just grow outward, but the patience of God is for me. Mm-hmm. And it isn't that we're not challenged to grow; we are all the time. But it was a very poignant reminder that the Lord would look at me and say, "What are you waiting for?
Yeah, yeah.
Grow. Continue to stretch yourself. Continue to mature." Mm. And I really appreciated that reminder from your sermon that the patience of God is not just for the lost; it's for those who name the name of Christ.
Yes.
Yes,
I love that. Yeah, the 2 Peter 3:18. So, a very heavily eschatological book ends with, "But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." Yeah,
yeah. I don't know if you've probably picked up on it now, but many people in this room have sort of grown up or simmered in the idea that salvation is that your disembodied soul will go to a spirit heaven when you die forever. That's salvation. And yeah, I know.
And that's the goal.
That's the goal. And so you want to get people to ask Jesus into their heart so that they'll go to heaven when they die.
Right.
And go to heaven is a disembodied spiritual thing. And so post-mill or any of that kind of thing, it seems like our, I don't know, challenge of when we're talking to people is not so much eschatology, like are you dispensational, and most are, but because people have made cleverly devised stories for it, and that's compelling.
Yeah.
But it seems like we're talking about, when you're talking about growth, maturity, the patience of God being for you, that's a little weird to some people. They're like, "I believe in Jesus.
Yeah, I'm saved. I'm done. Yeah."
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a number of things I want to say. So, first is the Hebrew and Greek words for heaven are used several hundred times in the Bible, Old and New Testaments. There is not one single occasion when either in the Old Testament or the New Testament the word heaven is used as a description of the everlasting abode of the righteous. It's never, ever used. It doesn't and cannot ever mean that. And it is one of the most astonishing and actually destructive abuses of biblical language to use the word heaven to describe the eternal state. The reason it gets used in that way is, well, there's a number of reasons, but one of them is that heaven is used as the name for the temporary dwelling place of the souls or hearts or minds of the redeemed as they await the resurrection and the renewal of the heavens and the earth. And so resurrection, or perhaps glory, if you want a one-word description of the future destination, resurrection or glory is an appropriate term. Heaven is not. So there's that you're pointing out. Just for the sake of it, any of you, and this is what, I know what happens, you come to a place where you're being sort of theologically stretched a little bit from a world where you've learned to speak and think in certain ways. I want to blast the cobwebs away with a blowtorch. So You are not being, you're not compromising what your grandmother told you by refusing to speak of your future destination as heaven. You're being faithful to Scripture. Heaven is where you will go temporarily, if you die tonight, before the resurrection of all things. And then where you will live forever is in a renewed and transformed or resurrected heavens and earth. Okay, so that's the eschatological point there. Right now, the question then arises, all right, so what are we supposed to do in the meantime? And the answer is, well, you live in such a way as to instantiate the future in the present. Just think now, kind of in more kind of philosophical or conceptual way. Faith is a commitment of the heart by which you believe the truth of things that cannot be seen, either because they're invisible, like God, or because they haven't happened yet. Hebrews 11. Now, Hebrews 11, what's fascinating, the faith chapter, faith is the conviction of things not seen, and you look through the list, and they're all, none of them are invisible things. They're just not yet happened things. And so what faith is, faith looks to our future and seeks to embody that in our present. You with me? So growth in maturity for the cosmos, for the whole world, is this day-by-day process of heading towards the final judgment and the resurrection of all things, the general resurrection, and the renewal of the heavens and the earth. That's the maturation of the cosmos. The maturation of a human being who's living in this little slice of time here is you are, so to speak, inhabiting and living in a way that comports with that future destination. So picture yourself as a five-year-old child who your mum or your dad says, I wish you'd just grow up. And suddenly you flip a switch, maybe you don't flip a switch, but you start behaving like a grown-up. Have you ever had, you've got kids like this, you have kids who on their best moments, though they're 6 or 7 or 8 years old, they're capable of relating to adults, like an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old. And you say, and your guests who are with you for the evening, and they go home and you say to little Johnny, you are very mature tonight. We're very proud of you. And the reason you're mature is because you, the child, were behaving in a way that can reasonably be expected of somebody who's a number of years older. That's what maturity is. So you are a child, because that's the only way to come to Jesus. Well done.
Amen.
Yeah, and so now you are to behave like the full-grown man that you will one day be. Who is the full-grown man? It's Jesus. So you will be so united with Christ in glory, resurrection, that we will be like him because we will see him as he is. By faith, we're united with him now, yes? So we're back to faith again. Faith looks to our future because it looks to Christ now. So the task of Christians is not simply to go out and find a whole bunch of other people to sort of snatch them off the burning deck of the sinking ship. It is rather, we've been, the image I prefer to use, rather than you're on a sinking ship, that this ship isn't sinking. You've been planted as the new inhabitants of a vast and unpeopled continent. Yeah, come on, catch up. And your task is to settle here. And build for the future. And one day the king is coming, but when he comes, he won't be coming to take you away, he'll be coming to move in with you. You better get this thing ready. And you've got, you know, 80 years. So you want to build something that your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren can build upon. This is why Christians start schools and hospitals. It's why Christians build great cathedrals. It's why Christians invest in their children and in the godliness that they need to be great parents to their children and great examples to the other people around them. Some of you here are married and you've got kids. Some of you older, you've not had children, or you've had children that left home. All of you are part of a family, and your character is part of what shapes this whole community, so the whole community grows together in maturity, so that you're behaving like the grown-ups in the room, like the ones who are like a bit more like what you'll be one day because you're a bit more like what Jesus is now. You with me? So it's a very different picture of life than just grab the life belt, because the ship's going down. Yeah.
That sort of the price of admission, right there. That's
what the price of admission.
That was the offering, man.
Raymond.
I deal with people who say that you have to choose Christ day to day, moment to moment, or you won't get there.
Yeah. That's very wisely put. You have to choose Christ from day to day, moment to moment, or you won't get it. Yeah. So Paul says in Colossians 1, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel.
That's the idea, but the idea is that you choose.
Yeah.
And Calvinists, I believe, God chose.
Oh, hold on a second. I need to borrow a child. Can I borrow a child?
Borrow
yeah.
Children.
Yeah, out here. Yeah, he needs to come out here. I'm really sorry. He's like, seriously? No, it's okay. It's okay.
I thought you were joking.
No. You have to watch out. This is a smart one.
What do I do this
time? No. I want you to. Sorry, what's your name?
Prosper.
Prosper, good to meet you, Steve. I want you to imagine that Prosper is like 8 months old and he's just learning to walk. All right. Now. And I'm like Prosper. Is he your son? Right. He was so proud. Okay. Now, I could imagine, like I did with my kids, holding you by the scruff of your shirt. I'm not going to because it's a beautiful shirt and I'll ruin it. But holding you like this, and you're learning to walk, and you take your first steps like this, right? Go walk. You can do it, Prosper. You can do it. Now, hold on. Was Prosper walking? Yes. Now, if I'd let him go. Oh, yeah, I think he was there. Now, and here's the thing. I think we do sometimes get nervous with some of our friends who don't have self-consciously Calvinist convictions about God's sovereignty. So you're right, I think, sir, to be a little nervous about that. But.
There are more of them.
Right. But it's not your job to fix them.
No.
What I want to help you to understand is
very clear to me.
Right, of course. But what I want to help all of us understand is it the case that we must choose to follow Christ every day? Yes. And when we do so, we discover that there's been somebody behind kind of carrying us. And that's not semi-Pelagian. Technical term, I know some of you understand that. It's not semi-Pelagian, it's recognizing that it is, it's Philippians 2, it's work out your salvation with fear and trembling because it is God who is working in you. It's 100% God, 100% us. And it's us because it's God. So it's not an either or, and it's not he does his bit and I do my bit, it's I do what he's called me to do, and I discover on the last day that he was working in and through me every step of the way. So your pastor, one more example, your pastor labors night and day and hours on his pastoral ministry and in prayer and in sermons, and he stands up in front of you, and who speaks? It's the Spirit of God. So it's okay, you don't need to work anymore. Wrong. Yeah, because the Spirit of God is at work in him to do what he is doing. You with me? So your question is a very, very insightful one. And I'd encourage you to just put a smile on your face, post-meal spirituality, chill with your friends. But if you embody and live out the dependence on the Lord, then that's probably more persuasive than any argument.
Outside my philosophy would not see a difference. Mm.
You might not see a difference. You know, it's possible to be self-consciously Arminian and still be saved by the Calvinist God that you don't quite believe in. You know what I mean? It's not ideal. I mean, ideal. But it's...
Well, we're both working really hard on ourselves.
Yes, exactly. Well, and let me, I'll give you one more example. I keep saying one more. Who am I kidding? I used to do some evangelism in London with a group of people in Enfield, where they make the rifles, Enfield rifles.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
303.
Yeah, that's right. It's 303. They used to make them. And now, we used to hand out tracts and do interviews and conversations. And now, most of them were premill dispensationalist charismatic Arminian ladies. Wild. It was, and yet we worked together really well. Now, it would have been hopeless if they joined the church where I was pastoring, or if I tried to go and preach to their church, it would be a disaster. But we could do this together, because we're dealing here with kind of such basics. It's like, have you heard about Jesus? Who's Jesus? You know, it's like, okay. At this point, we're pulling in the same direction, and it was a real blessing to be able to work with those ladies and the one or two guys who were there as well.
That's great. Our time's about up. I think I saw Scott's hand. Scott, do you have a quick question? You've never had one before, but if you have a quick question now, we'll take it.
You said one of the reasons you moved to All Saints was so that you could focus more on pastoral duties and evangelism.
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
My question was, what does evangelism look like at All Saints?
Pardon me. If I said evangelism in that context, I misspoke. What evangelism looks like at All Saints, I can answer that. I think it's one of our weaknesses. But I can tell you that it... Let me tell you about our aspirations, which occasionally, by God's grace, have been met. What I'd like us to be is not that the pastor beats everybody up every week because they've not brought three Christian friends to church, non-Christian friends to church, or they've not shared the gospel with somebody every day for the last week. We don't want to be like that. We want to be a place where first, our Christian commitment is visible to people around us, neighbours, co-workers. Secondly, where we are ready and able to talk about that as though it's the most natural thing in the world. And then thirdly, where we have the kind of church community into which we can invite those people and we can show them a glimpse of that future that we're trying to invite them to. So if you have the snatch from the deck of the burning ship view of the Christian life, it generates a snatch from the deck of the burning ship view of evangelism. Whereas if you have a build a new world view of the Christian life, it generates a welcome people into the new world view of evangelism. And I can tell you, there's a couple with a couple of kids at church, a small family, that joined because one of their neighbors, who's a member at All Saints and has been for many years, it's another lovely family, just got talking to them. And they hadn't been to church for years, feeling guilty about it, feeling like maybe we should go back to church, not really sure where to go, tried a few, nobody spoke to them there for 3 months, don't really want to go there. Okay, maybe we'll go to All Saints just once. And they came, and it's like, oh wow, these people are not, and they stayed, and now they're members.
All right, sorry, Raymond. We gotta. We're gonna have the kids.
This will praise you. Everybody wants to talk, but nobody wants to listen.
Yeah. Well, we're about to be descended upon by the children from Saint School.
All right,
and they do not want to listen. So, let me close this with prayer. Our Father, we thank you for the word for worship.